Klaus sits on the dunes at night, and Den Helder, luring butterflies and moths into his traps with a bright light, he lets most of them go. The few he keeps will help researchers understand and conserve insect diversity. Catching caterpillars is easy.
You can find a lot of caterpillars using UV light at night, so they glow in the dark. And sometimes you can beat the bushes and then they fall out.
Do you see there being a reason for documenting the diversity? Why do it?
Well, if you don't know what's around, you don't know what to protect.
Yeah, partly it's an academic question to know what's out there. But we have to realize that we humans are part of this Earth, of this ecosystem. So we really need all other species on Earth.
We certainly need beetles. These are the insects Jan Wieringa collects for DNA barcoding and preservation here at Naturalis. Before they get shelved, Wieringa pins them up in public. It's the tiny beetles that amaze people the most.
Families with children come to my table and see that I'm mounting a beetle of only 2 millimeters. And they say, oh, that's a small thing, what is that? That's a beetle. But in their mind, beetles are always 2 or 3 centimeters, because those are the beetles that they're seeing. They're only seeing the really huge longhorn beetles or big ones that are on flowers. That's what they know. They never really dig into their garden and see that within those leaves there are all kinds of much smaller insects crawling around. So I'm educating the public, and I hope that by seeing that there's so much more out there, especially small, and that they really have to start looking, that they'll start appreciating it more.
If we go to this one, we can go in here.
The most amazing creatures to behold here at Naturalis are the ones the public doesn't get to see. 20 floors of specimens in glass-topped boxes tucked into tall sliding shelves.
We have an estimation of currently 43 million specimens. But that's just an estimation, because we didn't count every single insect.
In a nearby lab, a pair of students are prepping specimens to be barcoded. DNA barcodes are short sequences of the genetic alphabet unique to each living kingdom. Animals have one, plants another, fungi yet another. Within any of these broad groups, DNA barcodes vary from species to species. Here at Naturalis, barcodes are read using a device the size of a computer printer, then matched with known barcodes in the world's biggest databases. In addition to their own archived specimens, Naturalis barcodes environmental samples scientists and ordinary people bring in, fistfuls of soil, ghost nets pulled out of the North Sea, covered in life, vials of turbid water from a stream or lake. Kevin Bainchus leads the sequencing work.
I mean, it's ridiculous when you think about it that you take a liter of water. How much life can there be in such a small volume of water? And it's literally hundreds or even thousands of different species that we find.
In water that's essentially clear. I mean, you don't see fish, things swimming around in it. Yet there's like a thousand or more species of life in
there. Yeah, you filter the water, and of course, when you examine the filter afterwards, it's a little brown, greenish color. But basically, we're looking at DNA traces that are left behind, and we're not catching any specimens. I mean, we're catching, of course, the microscopic life forms, but I'm not catching any fish. But we find several dozens of fish in just a liter of water. It's, marvelous.
Like supermarket barcodes in the commercial world, DNA barcodes enable natural resource managers to inventory, track, and conserve animals, plants, and other life forms in the ecosystems we humans inhabit.
We want to know all life on Earth, basically, at some point. And we don't know many of the organisms that are there. But it's also about what are the functions for the ecosystem, and also what are the functions, finally, for humans, for us.
Back in the park, Michael Steck has just switched off his pollen sniffer and is inspecting the sticky slide inside.
Let's see if we have caught something.
It's like fishing.
It is fishing in the air, yes. Oh, yes. You can even see it with the naked eye.
Steck takes a closer look with his hand lens.
Oh, that's interesting.
Among the bryophyte and fungal spores that fascinate Steck the most, detritus from the world humans have created.
Fibers in different colors, green and red, maybe microplastics.
It's a far cry from what Aristotle and Pliny observed thousands of years ago. The human detritus they came across, large and tiny, would have been local in origin. Today, human materials and chemicals swamp nature and endanger species. All the more reason to take stock of the living.
And also different pollen grains, bigger ones, the smaller ones.
Read more about DNA barcoding and the Arise Biodiversity Project here in the Netherlands at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Surface is a little over 1 degree warmer today on average than it was at the start of the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago. That doesn't seem like much. Under the Paris Agreement, governments agreed to limit temperature rise to 2 degrees. At present emission rates, that target will likely be exceeded. In a landmark report published in the prestigious Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences back in 2018, researchers warned that a 2-degree rise in global surface temperature may actually exceed a critical planetary threshold, pushing Earth down a cascade of tipping points into hothouse mode, unlike anything this third rock from the sun has experienced since the mid-Miocene epoch 15 million years ago. I spoke with the lead author of that report, Will Steffen. You're associated with these ideas together with Johan Rockström of planetary boundaries and safe operating space, which is kind of apropos to our conversation right now.
Absolutely. Johan came up with the idea of planetary boundaries, and they are designed to say what is required to keep the Earth in a Holocene state, the Holocene being the last approximately 12,000-year geological epoch. It's the last interglacial in that series of glacial-interglacial cycling, and it's very important for humans because this, during the last 12 years, we've developed agriculture, settlements, more complex societies, etc. So the idea of the planetary boundaries was to explore, using the best science we could, how far can you push the Earth system and various important processes in the Earth system before you transgress Holocene bounds and move the system onto another state. This paper is a natural follow-on to the planetary boundaries in a way, saying we know that we're exceeding some of the planetary boundaries. We know we've actually left the Holocene. There's an enormous amount of evidence. We're in what Paul Crutzen has termed the Anthropocene. But that the Earth system's not in a stable state now. It's in a highly transient state. And where might it go? So that was the motivation for bringing together 13 or 14 scholars from around the world who are all interested in and are experts in various aspects of this question. So that was really the motivation for the paper.
And that that other notion of safe operating space suggests that Earth is no longer seemingly, thanks largely to human beings, Earth is no longer at a steady state, and it may potentially no longer at some point, it may no longer be a safe operating space for human beings.
Yeah, in fact, one could make the argument because some of the planetary boundaries, the two really important ones, climate change and biosphere integrity, have already been transgressed. Biosphere integrity probably more seriously. You could argue that we're no longer really in a safe operating space, and we can already see that in a way. For example, with the increase in extreme weather events, heat waves, more intense tropical cyclones, bushfires, that sort of thing, it's telling us we're no longer really in a safe operating space. And of course, it's really the most vulnerable people around the planet who are already starting to feel the impacts of that. We're no longer in a safe operating space. We're in a transient phase. The Earth system is shifting. It's no longer in a in a stable state. And the question is, what trajectory might it take in the future, and what is the role of humans in that trajectory?
Well, let's get to that shortly. But in terms of this notion of possible sliding or slipping or sliding into hothouse Earth, how hot could it get if things we slipped into that uncontrollable mode? How hot could planet Earth, surface the Earth, get?
Well, we're suggesting 4 to 5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, and that's based on paleoclimate analogs that if we go toward mid-Miocene conditions, which is about 15 million years ago, so it's not all that long ago, really, in Earth history, that's the last time we saw CO2 up between 400 to 500 parts per million, and the temperatures were 4 to 5 degrees higher, a big range of estimates of sea level rise, probably at least 10 meters higher than today, but it could go as high as 30 or 40 meters higher eventually. So we know that in the very recent past, the Earth is actually capable of being in such a state. So our analysis suggests that if we do cross what we're proposing as a planetary threshold and trigger a lot of feedbacks that put more carbon into the atmosphere, as well as decrease ice much more rapidly, and therefore increase the absorption of sunlight, you could very well get to mid-Miocene conditions. And we say it could be as fast as a century or two.
And that would be a global average. You speak about 4 to 5 degrees Celsius post-industrial. That would be a global average. You'd see exceedances, temperature rises way higher than that.
Yeah, in fact, we're already seeing that. You know, we had an excursion in the Arctic region of somewhere around 30 degrees Celsius above average for a couple of weeks, which is absolutely remarkable. But I think if you just look at average, the northern high latitudes, and of course this is very important for Canada, the northern high latitudes are warming at roughly twice the global rate. So if that ratio holds in the future, you could see temperatures 8 to 10 degrees higher than pre-industrial in the northern high latitudes.
What is a positive feedback, and can you describe some of these sorts of positive feedbacks that happen?
Yeah, positive is probably not a good word for the general public. It's one we use in science. Positive means reinforcing. It means it reinforces the driving force that triggered the feedback in the first place. So basically in our paper, we look at two types of these feedbacks, carbon cycle feedbacks and ice albedo feedbacks. But a good example of a carbon cycle feedback is, in fact, what we've just been talking about, the vast boreal northern forests. And they store a lot of carbon, and they could act as a carbon sink if they are healthy and maintained in a viable state. But as they are increasingly at risk of burning, which we've talked about, but also insect infestation, the spruce bark beetle is a classic case there. It's affected a lot of forests in British Columbia, for example. What's happening is as these forests are weakened by insect attacks and then burned, they are releasing carbon back to the atmosphere. Interestingly, the best data we have actually comes from Canada. It comes from the Canadian Forest Service. And they've been doing very meticulous surveys of the carbon dynamics of those forests over a century. And what they find is that indeed, up until around 1970 or so, the Canadian boreal forests were actually removing carbon from the atmosphere in a net sense. But as the temperature has warmed, you get more fires, more insects, and these forests are now at best carbon neutral, and in bad years, they're actually a net emitter of carbon to the atmosphere. So this is a positive feedback. The Earth warms, it makes Canadian boreal forests more vulnerable, they burn, they emit carbon to the atmosphere, and it warms it even more.
And then the reduction of Earth's albedo, talk about that.
Yeah, well, that happens as ice sheets shrink. Again, the most vulnerable one is the Arctic sea ice, summer sea ice. So this is the ice that floats over the Arctic Ocean during summertime. Normally it would be a few meters thick. It's not only been thinning out, it's also been decreasing in area. So when it decreases in area in the summertime, of course that's when the sun is over the far north, instead of reflecting sunlight, it's absorbing. The darker ocean water absorbs sunlight. And this leads to further regional warming. And of course, as it warms further, the ice shrinks further back, which uncovers even more water. It warms even more, and so on. This is another example of a feedback loop. So we're talking about two types of positive feedback loops, one involving the carbon cycle, the other involving ice albedo effect.
And then you conjure up the notion of tipping points that, you know, as Earth's system warms, accelerated by positive feedbacks of various types, we theoretically approach a tipping point where suddenly things go completely nonlinear, and there might even be a sequence of tipping points. Can you figure three in your article for the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences kind of suggests that there might be three tiers of tipping points. The first between 1 to 3 degrees warming, and then between 3 to 5 degrees warming, and then another tipping point when we suddenly exceed 5 degrees. Can you talk to me about that?
Well, really what we're talking about, yes, in our figure three is a cascade of these, like a row of dominoes. And you start tipping the first dominoes, and they tip the next one, which tips the next one, and so on. And people are familiar, I think, with that analogy. But if you like, our tipping elements, which sit in the 1 to 3 degree category, are the dominoes at the front of the line of dominoes, and then the ones 3 to 5 are in the middle, and the ones 5 are at the end. So the idea is...
And go through those. What are the first ones? What are the second ones? What are the third ones?
Yeah, well, we've talked about one of the first ones, and that's the Arctic summer sea ice. We also think, by the way, up in the far north, the Greenland ice sheet might be vulnerable somewhere around 2 to 3 degrees. Coral reefs, which actually don't act too much as a domino, we think they're really vulnerable at 1.5. We'll lose most of them. The West Antarctic ice sheet, alpine glaciers. So there's a lot of vulnerable ice here that is thought to be have tipping points 1 to 3 degrees. And most of those are sort of in the polar areas. But they're going to unleash stronger regional warming. And if the warming then goes up toward 3 degrees, we have a whole set of tipping points which may be further vulnerable. One of them we talked about, the boreal forests, and we know that they're already showing signs of vulnerability a bit over 1 degree. So that may be it may be an underestimate. We may see action at 2 degrees on the boreal forest. Nevertheless, they're put in the 3 to 5 at the moment. The Indian summer monsoon season, the North Atlantic circulation system, the Amazon forest, are all in that category. Now, of course, the Amazon forest would release an enormous amount of carbon to the atmosphere as well. Then if you get those going, then you go back to the poles, and there's some more recalcitrant ice that could be vulnerable at 5 degrees. And that's the permafrost, which would release carbon. That's mainly in eastern Siberia. Ocean methane hydrates, that's methane stored in ocean sediments. And even the East Antarctic ice sheet, which is the big one. I mean, that's the big, very stable one. At 5 degrees, we're worried that could be unstable. So it acts like a wave of tipping elements that start at the poles, go down toward the mid-latitudes and equator, and then come back to the poles. So it's like a stack of a weaving stack of dominoes that once you start tipping them, the whole thing may go. So when you put that whole story together, we propose that there could be what we call a planetary threshold, which is once those dominoes start falling, you can't stop it. And that would equate to a threshold that would eventually take the Earth system onto that hothouse trajectory that we postulate in this paper.
And that could be like at 2 degrees Celsius. Here we're talking about trying to achieve the Paris target of 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, and everybody thinks of that as being kind of the conservative approach, but we don't know whether or not at 2 degrees Celsius we might set the dominoes falling, and then even reductions would be for naught.
That's exactly right. Our best estimate is that we're still pretty safe at 1.5, the lower the Paris targets. You'll get some of the tipping elements like coral reefs will go, but we don't think the domino effect is very likely at 1.5. At 2 degrees, it's more possible. It's hard to put a number on that probability until we do more research. So at the moment, really what we're putting forward here is a risk analysis. But what we're saying is as you go beyond the Paris targets toward 3 degrees, the risk rises quite sharply. It's a nonlinear function. So that there's a real risk at 3 degrees, we think, that you're going to hit those, that domino effect and push the system out of our control. So when you work backwards then, when you look at the pledges that countries have made in response to the Paris targets, that would take the Earth to about 3 degrees. So right now the stated level of ambition around the world is far, far too weak to keep this risk at a low level.
And this one of the scary, amongst various scary ideas that you present in your paper, is this idea that we may have, unbeknownst to us, actually passed a fork in the road. Like here we're walking along a road, and there are various forks in the road leading to this runaway process, and we may have already passed one of the forks in the road.
Well, we actually say we have passed one fork in the road, and that fork in the road is the idea that if we could somehow take the pressure off, the Earth would go back down to the Holocene state, the period of the last 12,000 years. It won't. And there's good analyses already that we've already knocked the next glacial state out. In other words, about every 100,000 years, you go through one of these cycles of a long glacial and a short interglacial. Well, we've missed the next glacial already, so we've crossed one fork of the road. And of course, some people argue, well, we wouldn't want to go into a glacial state anyway. And that may be true, but as Paul Crutzen said way back in the year 2000, if we were really smart, we would inject just the right amount of designer greenhouse gases to keep the Holocene state going. And of course, we're not doing that. We're massively overloading the system with greenhouse gases. So that fork in the road we talk about in the paper is the fact we've left the Holocene, we're in the Anthropocene. And we also make a really important point, is that this 1.5 to 2 degree world, the Paris target world, is not an intrinsically stable state of the Earth system. It has to be managed and maintained through human stewardship, ongoing stewardship. So I think that's a very important point that people need to make, is we are already committed to being stewards of the Earth system. The question is, are we going to be good stewards, effective stewards, or is the system going to get out of control?
And there we confront something you refer to called a technological lock, that we, you know, it's great notion that we should be good stewards. Let's start being good stewards, but we're kind of locked in technologically and in the grip of socioeconomic inertia.
Yeah, I mean, those are huge issues. And I'll have to say, although we flag a lot of those issues, because of the constraints of the paper and the fact that we wanted to get the geophysical Earth system story really clearly out there, we don't go into enough detail on exactly the issues that you're raising. And that needs to be urgently addressed by experts in socioeconomics, technology, political science, ethics, values. You know, so we need historians, we need philosophers, and so on, ethicists, to really, really take a really hard look at contemporary human societies and say what needs to be changed so that we do become effective stewards of the planetary system.
I mean, can we turn things around while at the same time embracing this notion of permanent growth?
Well, certainly I don't think so. Not material growth, and of course that's what we're seeing is that not only are we putting an enormous amount of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, when you look at the other parts of the Earth, we're putting enormous amounts of plastics into the ocean. We're spreading the Earth's surface in concrete. There are all sorts of indicators that people who are studying the Anthropocene from a geological stratigraphic point of view are saying this is really astounding. What's happening to planet Earth. So yes, I think it's pretty clear that we cannot go on with business as usual or minor modifications of business as usual. We need a pretty comprehensive overhaul of what I might call a human enterprise.
Will Steffen was an eminent Earth system scientist, a native of Norfolk, Nebraska. Steffen emigrated to Australia in the 1970s, where he took up a position at the Australian National University in Canberra. Steffen served as the executive director of the International Geosphere Biosphere Program, a groundbreaking initiative aimed at studying the chemical, physical, and biological processes governing Earth as a system. His name came to be associated with a host of ideas about our planet and humanity's fate on it: planetary boundaries, safe operating space, Stefan's great acceleration curves helped corroborate the idea, first proposed by Paul Crutzen, that Earth has entered a new epoch, the Anthropocene. Will Stefan passed away in January 2023. We'll post a link to a commemoration of Will Stefan's life and scientific accomplishments at greenplanetmonitor.net. Today's GPM coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions, Breda in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. And please subscribe. A pop-up box will be popping up real soon. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Bull trout, Athabasca rainbow trout, and West Slope cutthroat trout live in icy streams that flow down from the mountains of Alberta, Canada. But as the climate warms, those streams are warming too, causing these fish to retreat into the dwindling refuges of cold water upstream.
As it warms downstream, it forces them further upstream into an ever-shrinking available amount of habitat.
Ben Kissinger is a water and fish scientist with the FRI Research Group. He says the problem is made worse by the loss of many streamside trees and plants, which used to shade the water from the hot sun. All three trout populations face other threats, too.
If you have all those other threats like angling pressure and fragmentation and habitat loss on top of warming waters, that really makes it hard for these species to exist.
So Kissinger is mapping water temperatures in Alberta's streams to better understand how the trout's habitat is changing. He says it's important to protect streamside vegetation and the remaining stretches of cold water,
because those might be crucial refuges for these cold water species as we move into a warming future.
So Kissinger's research could help these trout survive even as the climate continues to warm. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
This is Bird Note. You don't need to travel to Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, or even to a remote forest, to see owls. Some owls, including big birds like barred owls and great horned owls, live in the city. Owls are hunters, and there's a lot to eat in the city, like rats or even squirrels. Great horned owls favor urban parks, cemeteries, and botanical gardens, places with big trees. They're huge owls with pointy, ear-like tufts, and they roost during the day in trees and hunt at night over open areas nearby. Look for something shaped like an enormous house cat sitting upright on a branch. At night, listen for these mellow hoots. Barred owls sound rowdy by comparison. The barn owl also likes parks, especially with open spaces below the trees, because it hunts mostly inside the woods. It's big, too, with a smoothly rounded head, and it sometimes perches down low where it's easy to spot. We hope you can find owls near where you live. Take a pair of binoculars so you can watch them at a distance that's comfortable for you and for the owl. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Bird Note is supported by American Bird Conservancy, dedicated to conserving wild birds and their habitats throughout the Americas. Learn more at abcbirds.org.
Radio Rewind.